This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Basic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network, the show trainers listen to. And of course, we welcome you to our brand new Sirius XM channel, Sirius 220 XM 206, and happy to have you with me here this evening. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, my producer, Lee Delapina. We are in studio here in Lexington, Kentucky, and ready to roll for the next hour as we visit with a couple of the people that helped to make this sport a success. They do it every single day of their lives. It's 365 days a year. 7 days a week. There are no holidays, no days off. I'm talking about the trainers in the sport, and each week I have the privilege of visiting with so many of those people. Tonight, no exception. Going to kick things off with Marcus Vitale, the native of Rhode Island. 679 winners to his credit. His runners have amassed purse earnings of more than, how about this, $8.3 million. And 2014 may be his greatest year yet. Marcus has saddled the winners of the Grade 1 Gulfstream Park Turf Handicap and the Grade 2 Monmouth Cup, and he is with me now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Marcus, thanks for taking the time.
Anytime.
Yeah, happy to have you on board with me here today. And let's spend a few minutes looking back on this year, 2014. When I mention those numbers, I talk about those big wins, what goes through your mind when you reflect on the past few months?
Well, what goes through my mind is been a long road. I've been doing this since 1967, when I was 7 years old, walking horses at Narragansett Racetrack in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. So from then till now, you know, I worked my way up from a hot walker, pony boy. I was a jockey for a short period of time, an assistant trainer, groom. What you can do in the industry, I've done. And I built myself a little stable after my mentor, Eddie Vasci, passed away. And here I am today. And what goes through my mind is I've been very fortunate enough to acquire some great owners and people who believed in me. And I'm here today in Florida enjoying the sport.
Have you actually taken the time, maybe in the past month or 2 months, to actually reflect on where you started and everything that you have achieved in your career?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think about it every day, where I came from. I never forget where I started and, you know, where I've gotten to. And, you know, good horses, good people. You know, it's a hard question to answer. It's just a million things go through my mind every day. I go to the barn every morning with a smile on my face. I enjoy the sport. I love to win. I love the people in the industry. I support all the owners and breeders and, you know, my colleagues. And, you know, believe me, like you said earlier, 365 days a year. It's not easy, and you know, I go in every day and I roll up my sleeve and I just, you know, go to work and hope to produce winners.
Well, if it was easy, everyone would do it, that's for sure. And we're going to spend plenty of time here over the next 25 minutes or so talking about how you got started, some of the other roles that you've had throughout your career as you've gotten to this point, Marcus. But just want to spend another moment on Lochte and winning that Gulfstream Park Turf in February. The countless of hours and sacrifices that you made over the years coming to a head at that moment. You've gone through the highs, you've gone through the lows. That was certainly a high. How emotional was that moment when he crosses the finish line?
I get emotional right now talking about it. It was incredible. It was a horse purchased at the sales. My owner gave me the liberty to, spend that kind of money. And, me and her really thought hard and went through the book. And credit to Dr. Hart, one of our veterinarians. And we trudged through the sales grounds for a couple days. And she came up with a few horses. I came up with a few horses. And, of course, Lati and Valid was in that selection. And, the day he won that race was, incredible. I honestly don't take the credit for going in there because I thought there was a softer spot. And I knew his numbers were going up and he was getting better. And, my boss said, hey, let's take a chance. What do we got to lose, And, it was exciting. I'll tell you, it was first grade one for me. It's like I said, it was a very emotional day.
That's another part of training horses that oftentimes gets overlooked. The fact that not only are you out there putting in the countless hours at the barn every morning at the racetrack, but you're working the sales. You're looking for the next good horse that you can put into your stable. And you mentioned going through looking at numerous horses at the sale, and here comes Lochte. What was it about Lochte that made you think, okay, he's the right one?
Well, I shouldn't say we. My boss, Miss Vogel, had him mocked on her catalog page to be looked at. I also had him mocked, but we went over and, we looked at him, and we liked what we saw. Of course, we had Dr. Hart examine him, and he looked at me and I looked at him and he said, I think you can handle this horse, we decided to bid on him. And I think every time I bid, she kicked me under the chair. I thought that meant to raise my hand for more money. So he was pretty impressive. The camp that had him is a tremendous camp. And, I just felt that, it would be something nice to work with. You know what I mean?
Trainer Marcus Vitale joining me on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All right, Marcus, let's go back to the beginning. You mentioned growing up in Rhode Island. You mentioned the name Narragansett, which some people may have forgotten by now, but what are those earliest memories that you have of being introduced to the sport?
Well, it's funny. My father owned a couple horses, and I had a couple ponies, and I used to do the barrel racing and, a little horse showing here and there. And, I just used to – I fell in love with it. I got to go on weekends and walk the horses, clean the water buckets and – I got to roll some bandages, and it was at 7 and 8 and 9 years old I wasn't looking to go to the football game. I was looking to go to the racetrack.
This is all you ever wanted to do?
All my spare time after that was, I wanted to be at the track. I wanted to be on the backside.
Wow. And then you mentioned briefly riding on the New England Fair Circuit. That was, I guess, in your teenage years. I don't think you ended up winning a race in the saddle, but what did that experience teach you?
It taught me that I would probably be a better horse trainer than a jockey.
You knew right away.
Well, it was like, you're a little kid and, they say you can't do it. So I just proved that I could do it. Not that I was successful at it, but I could do it.
I spent some time at Northampton. I called a few races up there and grew up not too far from Great Barrington. And that fair circuit in New England, a lot of people won't realize that fair circuit was booming for a long time. And it was a lot of fun whenever you went to any of those racetracks.
It was more enjoyment. We had it's kind of hard to rewind the clock because times have changed so dramatically in the sport. From, you know, after the races, everybody got together and had a cookout in the back and, you know, played the guitar. And, you know, it was just a tremendous amount of fun and gratification if, you know, a horse that you groomed or rode or, you know, walked that day one. It was just, you know, you felt a part of, you felt a great part of it.
Did you ever get the chance to ride for Carlos Figueroa?
No, I never did.
He wouldn't give you a leg up?
Well, I don't think I pretty much solicited to try to ride for him, to tell you the truth. he was a character. He was one of a kind. I think today he still holds the title King of the Fairs.
Yeah, the King of the Fairs for sure, and somebody that was highly respected up there on that fair circuit. Marcus, we're doing this interview one day after the news comes out about Suffolk Downs and the apparent demise of Suffolk Downs. That's kind of your home track. You've been there for a long time. And even though this show is much more about you and your career, and we're going to talk about that, the news of Suffolk and everything that's gone on had to hit you pretty hard.
Yeah, it was pretty heart-wrenching. I mean, you know, all those people in New England, I still own a farm there in Attleboro, Massachusetts. It's still operating. It was a tough blow for New England racing, but, you know, it's like anything else. I guess the people have spoken, and I hope everybody's strong enough to pick their heads up and go forward. And it kind of caught me a little bit in the heart, you know, and, it's a tough it's a tough day for New England horsemen.
Yeah, and people that come into racing now that hadn't followed it historically, they don't realize the significance that Suffolk Downs and even the now defunct Rockingham Park had on the sport back in the day. I mean, this was a prominent circuit for quite some time.
Well, you know, you say that, and growing up, you know, you couldn't wait for the changes. We went from, we had Lincoln Downs, we had Narragansett, we had Suffolk, we had Marshfield, Northampton, Great Barrington, Brockton. You know, we had so much racing, you never thought it was going to end. But unfortunately, one at a time, you know, they crumbled. And I don't know what the answer is to that, but like I said, you know, my heart goes out to all the owners of, you know, the people that picked up the pieces year after year and invested a lot of money into keeping them racetracks alive for the people of New England. My hat goes off to them. And, like I said earlier, you know, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, well said. And, certainly sad news coming out of New England recently. But, Marcus, let's get back to you here for just a minute. And in your career, so you go from the very short riding career and then decide, hey, I'm going to be a better horse trainer. When was it that you officially made the decision to start training horses?
Well, I stayed with Mr. Vashi. I trained a few horses. I started in 82. I always stayed with him. His nickname was Flash. He was a great mentor to me and a great horseman. He was phenomenal with bringing horses back, and, you know, he was phenomenal in the claiming game. And, you know, I absorbed a lot from Eddie, and, I stuck with him for years and years like glue. And I watched and I learned, and I just tried to pay attention. And I think, like going to school, I think, I went through my classes, and I think I graduated.
What's the biggest lesson that you learned in working with Eddie?
When he told me that when I had a couple of my own, that you do it this way and you don't do it that way, and I thought I was smarter than him, lesson learned that every time he was right and I was wrong. So when I got on track and I started doing what I was taught to do, not what I thought I wanted to do, the tide started to turn a little bit.
Yeah, this game has a funny way of humbling people, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Absolutely.
Marcus Vitale here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Marcus, what was the first horse that you saddled? Everybody always remembers their first.
I believe it was a horse called Bobby Hanna.
And where was that, Rockingham?
Actually, the first horse I saddled was at the fairs, and then Rockingham.
Okay. How about your first winner?
I don't know if you want to put this in here. I don't remember.
I think I read somewhere. No, and believe it or not, Marcus, you are not the first trainer to say that on this program. I've asked that question several times, and you'd be surprised how many times trainers go, geez, there's been so many. I don't remember.
It might have been Bobby Hanna, actually.
Okay.
At Marshfield Fair.
All right. Now, saddling horses at the fairs was a little bit different dynamic to what we see at most racetracks, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's just a total, like I said, the carnival, the people, the picnics and the cookouts and the guitar playing, and, you know, you don't see any of that anymore.
No, you really don't. Take me back to one of the earliest years when you started, I guess right around late 80s, I guess, when you started on your own, right? Is that right?
Well, yeah, late 80s, right? I started in 82, but, yeah, the late 80s, I really went on my own and started to build a little stable for myself.
I went back and looked on, according to Equibase, that year in 1989 is the first year they have you listed. You saddled 58 horses. You only had one winner, $5,800 in purses. How difficult were those early years?
Well, I was a part-time trainer back then. Of course, you can't do this being a part-time trainer. I was still working, of course, to make a week's pay. The great support of my family through all these years kept me in the business. But I can tell you there's never been a day I got up in the morning and I didn't want to go to work.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, what do they say?
Win, lose, or draw, you know, I get up every morning at 4:15. I try to be in the barn for 4:45. I was just getting done this morning, 12:30. I still do up a couple every day. I like to be more hands-on. There's nothing more I can say than I love doing what I do.
Yeah, it's great that you bring up the term hands-on, because I was going to ask you that question. Every time somebody talks about Marcus Vitale, or every time I read something about you, the term hands-on seems to be in there somewhere. And that's your approach to training horses, isn't it?
Well, I think it's what I learned from Eddie, because, you know, he worked every day. He did up every day. He was in his 60s. He was still getting under horses. And, you know, I remember getting yelled at for not sitting under the horse long enough and, you know, not walking him long enough and not doing this. And the bandage didn't look good. Take it off. Do it again. And I kind of still live with those expectations of my operation.
Are you the type of trainer that likes to put his hands on every horse in his barn if you can?
Well, I can surely tell you I look at every horse every day. I'd be lying to tell you if I put my hands on every horse every day. But truth be told, I do see every horse every day. I watch them jog. You know, I watch them train. I do up a couple. You know, I look them over good. I determine what we're going to do them up in each day. You know, I'm pretty close-knit with my staff. I got a great, great staff. I'm very dedicated and appreciative of the hours and the times they, you know, the hours they put in, and, you know, they do what I ask, and, you know, it's not easy. Believe me, it's not easy.
You know, you don't have a lot of horses in training, Marcus, so when you get an opportunity to go to a circuit like Florida, for example, and we mentioned winning the Gulfstream Park Turf Handicap with Lochte, but you get to go to these major circuits, and you're competing with the likes of Todd Pletcher and Bill Mott and Nick Zito and even Alan Jerkins and historic names in this sport. What's that like for you when you can actually get the best of them in a race like the Gulfstream Park Turf?
Well, you know, we can rewind the clock. I've competed with them on the lower level also, and as of some success. And, you know, like I said, you can't win them all, and you win some, you lose some. All those guys you mentioned, they're great horsemen. Can't take nothing away from them. I respect everybody in this game. I respect the guy with one horse. I respect the guy with 150 horses. I respect everybody. I know what it's like to get up every day and do this and deal with the trials and the tribulations of this sport, the ups and downs, the highs, the lows, the phone calls to the owners that are not so good, the phone calls that are great. You know, it's real personal to me. I got to give, you know, it's not an easy sport. And I give everybody credit for, you know, spending their time and their hours, you know, and their life devoted to these animals.
You know, Marcus, one thing I found very interesting, and I can't remember where I read it. It might have been in the barn notes at Gulfstream Park this past year, but it talked about you going to Florida, and when you got to Calder, you asked who the best trainer was, and you never stopped learning, and you wanted to learn everything you could about being in South Florida, being around the top trainers. You asked who the top blacksmith was, and those are all things that a lot of trainers may not take the time to do, but you do take the time to do that.
Well, I just thought from being in New England, the cold weather to the hot weather, and I spent my whole career in New England and then moving to South Florida and the first year going to Calder, you know, I wanted to follow the leader, so to speak. So Bill White, who became a friend of mine now, I think at that time was the leading trainer. And, you know, I called upon his vet, his blacksmith, what he said down there, you know, what made him so successful. I didn't change my style of training. I did change a few things I learned from Bill, and you know, I stuck with it, and it's proven to be quite successful for me.
Now, you said your dad owned a few horses. Are there any other members of your family that are involved in the sport?
No, there isn't any. There isn't any other members of my family that are involved in the sport.
Well, I think we know what your career highlight is to this point, but if you were to pick out the greatest training job that you've done to date, what would that training job be?
Well, I'm sure you could probably guess this one would be Valen and Lottie.
Yeah. Yeah, what makes them so special? And what makes the training job so special that you did with them?
Well, I right away, you know, we bought them. We sent them to Calder. Of course, they entered my stable, and we picked them apart, and we came up with a couple little things there, a couple little things there, and we addressed them, and both of those horses started to excel at the same time. And you know, back to the camp that had them, I bought them, and they had just recently been gelded. That could have had a lot to do with it also. And it was just a lot of hours and time. And, you know, my $5,000 claimers get treated as good as my grade one horse. You know, it's just I have an approach. No horse in my barn gets shuffled aside. We address every horse individually, and like I said, I got some great staff. Jenny Galf's horses, she's excellent. You know, I got Carlos. You know, I got Manny. I got some good people that give me some good input. You know, we work as a team. I don't do this all by myself. I just, you know, I can't do it. It doesn't It doesn't work like that. You know, I need my grooms to bring things to my attention. I need my riders to tell me what they feel. You know, I need to go over these things with my vet. I need to be prepared, you know, for the good, the bad, the ugly. And, you know, I'm a guy that's pretty much always got my horse ready to run at any time. I think my approach to training is probably, I start a lot of horses. I just think it's the way I condition versus the way somebody else conditions. You can talk to probably 100 trainers and you're going to get 100 different views.
You mentioned Lochte, you mentioned Valid. They certainly took things to another level this year. What, Marcus, are some of the future goals that you've kind of laid out for yourself and other things on your bucket list that you still want to accomplish in this sport?
Well, first thing in the sport, like you said, you know, it's a funny game. I don't have a bucket list in the horse racing industry. Every time you come up with a bucket list, somebody seems to, it doesn't usually work out. I just want to continue to do well for my clients. I want to continue to win races. I want to continue to love the sport as I do. I just want to continue to just do what I'm doing. That's all. I'm very grateful to have a job. I'm very grateful to have great owners. I'm very, very grateful for Cross Sabers for believing in me and giving me the opportunity to move my game up another notch in the industry. And all the other guys, when I left New England, the Goldbergs, the Catapanos, the Reese family, I'm missing the John Grassis of the world. It's just every owner that I have, I'm grateful every day that they stay with me and they believe in me and we work well together.
Well, Marcus, it's been an absolute delight to hear your story. We could have talked for another half hour easy, but really appreciate you taking the time. Like all of our guests who come on the program, you're going to receive a gift from one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so I will get those out to you. And again, greatly appreciate the time and all the best moving forward.
No, I really appreciate it. And I always love to talk about the industry anytime.
Marcus Vitale. Thanks, Marcus.
All right. Thank you very much. And I want to thank the people at Gulfstream Park for doing such a great job and the Strana Group and keeping us alive here in Florida.
You got it. Marcus Vitale here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Great story. Great story. Put your time in. Work hard. Good things will happen. And they've happened to Marcus Vitale. Second half of Trainer Talk coming up next here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Stay with us. The Fasig Tipton November sale is the market leader. The 2013 November sale had the highest average of any mixed sale in the world, with 24 horses selling for $1 million and higher, more than any other breeding stock sale in the world. And the 2013 November sale provided an outstanding weanling market with a $500,000 foal and a $100,000 plus average, while also producing the highest priced horse sold in North America last year when Better went under the gavel at $5.2 million. The Fasig Tipton November sale, Monday, November 3rd in Lexington, Kentucky. The market leader. Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
For racing coverage from the inside out.
I still kicked away and I thought I really had it until the 16th pole. Amazing little horse.
International English events.
A clear round and under the time limit will get you into the jump off.
And hard-fought Western competition.
Here we go, guys. Let's help him. You bet.
Woo!
Tune in to HRTV, the network for horse sports. Online at HRTV.com.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
More than ever, it's time to get with the program, the New York Bred Program. This is Tracy Egan inviting you to learn more about why so many people are excited about New York Breds. They are showing their quality in graded and open stakes races across the nation. Horses such as Cluster of Stars, Artemis Agroterra, The Lumber Guy, Discreet Mark, King Creesa, Wired Brian, and Day at the Spa. And when you race New York Breds in New York State, you can collect generous owner and breeder awards. So learn more at nybreds.com.
HRRN has a new home on SiriusXM Radio. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, the BrizNet.com call-in show, and the ExpressBet Weekend Stakes Preview Show can all be heard on their new channels, Sirius 220 and XM 206, and the Equine Forum, Saturdays 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Sirius 92 and XM 92, and always streaming live at horseracingradio.net. This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
This is Christophe Clément. You are listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in studio, along with my producer, Lee Delapina. Fun visit with Marcus Vitale in the first half of the program. It's always great to hear stories from people that have really put their time into this sport and have dedicated their entire lives to making what they do now a success and making the sport a success. Marcus, certainly one of those people. And our second guest, also cut from the same cloth. That's trainer Phil Sims, the 52-year-old who grew up just about an hour north of the horse capital of the world, Lexington, Kentucky. And he was raised in, believe it or not, Flemingsburg. It's about an hour and 15 minutes northeast of Lexington. He has sent out 401 winners in his career, and his purse earnings are approaching $10 million. How about that? He's Phil Sims, and he's with me now on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, I mentioned being raised here in the horse capital of the world, not too far from Lexington. That's got to be pretty special for you.
Sure it is. I grew up, of course, going to races as a child, going to Keeneland and River Downs and Old Latonia and, of course, Ellis Park and those tracks right around Kentucky.
You know, I want to get this out of the way right off the bat here. How often are you mistaken for former NFL quarterback Phil Sims?
Not much anymore. I used to be when I was in New Jersey a little bit, racing the Meadowlands years ago. You would call the Meadowlands, and they say, "Well, you want the Giants," but no, I want the racetrack.
Would people not much anymore? would people seriously think that it was Phil Sims who was sending out those horses?
At one time, some people sure did, but it's no longer.
Well, you wouldn't mind having his bankroll, though.
No, that'd be fine.
Well, take me back to the beginning. You grew up pretty close to Lexington, as you mentioned, and you're working on a horse and a cattle farm just a little bit north. Tell me about those early days and how you became hooked on the sport of horse racing.
Okay. Yeah, I grew up on a farm, and we had horses. Back then, that's back in the 70s, a lot of people had some brood mares. My father, he kept brood mares, raced a horse or two, didn't train, but owned a horse or two at the races. And we had cattle. Everybody raced a buck or two. And the farms were just more of a agriculture business at that point in the 70s and 80s. And during high school, I'd actually go to River Downs, claim some fillies for $2,500, $3,500 for broodmare prospects, and breed them, and then sell them back in the November sale at Keeneland.
You would do that when you were in high school? That's
sure
not.
Would, yeah.
It's a little bit different than what most high school kids are doing.
Yeah. It was a little different, but I loved it. Loved farm life, and that's kind of how I got going with it. And
what was your dad into horse racing at all?
He owned a horse or two. And had mares, had some mares, and sold the yearlings and as a crop every year. So it just kind of was into it. Not really serious about thinking about training horses or anything. We would keep a yearling or two, and every year, and we would break it at the farm, and then send it off to different trainers. But
did he encourage you to get involved with racing, or was that just kind of on your own?
That was pretty much strictly on my own. It was. I going to go to UK, try that out, and get an ag degree. But then I kind of the more I got into the horses, the more I really liked it, and then just started training. And then in around Lexington here, I guess I was 18 years old when we got my trainer's license.
Wow. So
King Dangerfield was a state steward at that time. So that's how long ago that's been.
Wow. So you didn't actually end up graduating from UK?
No, I did not. No. I just, not much to dismay of my parents. I did not.
Do you know? Yeah, they probably weren't too thrilled with that decision, right?
No. But they were okay with it after a while.
How long did it take them to come around?
Probably 10 years.
You're kidding. That's a long time to hold a grudge. Phil Sims here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So you go to UK, that doesn't quite work out because you want to be around the game. You know, I hear that from a lot of trainers that have appeared on this show, Phil, that they try to go to school, they try to get into something else, but the pull of the racetrack and of the industry is just so strong that it's in their blood. They have to be part of it.
It is. Once you start doing it, it's just hard. The excitement of it, and of course, there's more downs than ups, but the ups are so great that you just can't quit, because you get new horses coming on every year, and it's gets in your blood, and as you say, and you just love to do it, and that's what happened to me.
So let me ask you this question: You were 18 when you took out your trainer's license. I guess that was right around 1980.
Yes, I think it was. Uh-huh.
Okay, and I went back. Equibase lists all the statistics. I noticed that first year you go 0-5. That's not many starters. The second year you're just 2-23. So you're 2-28 your first 2 years. Was there a point when you said, maybe I made the wrong choice here?
No, not really. Just kept working hard, and so just had some homebred horses, and just tried to work my way up to it, and try to learn a lot of trial and error as well early in my career. And of course, it still is now. You never ever know everything. And but just kept working hard and kept going strong to keep the career going, and it seemed to work out okay.
Yeah, it's worked out very well for you, and that perseverance has served you very well. When you're getting started like that, how difficult is it for a trainer to get started on his own, especially at a young age like that, Phil?
It's tough because you have to prove yourself, of course. And I'm going to say it's probably harder now, though, for these young trainers than it was when I started.
Really? How come?
Your cost of operations now seem like they're so much more. and financially, it's going to be tough for him to do it. And when I started training, a lot of trainers would own their own horses. Now rarely do you see young trainers owning any of their own horses. So that's why I started. I started mainly just with my own horses, or maybe a horse or two for someone else. But it'd be difficult for these young trainers to get a number of horses to train.
Yeah, your first winner was a horse that you owned, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Bodash, am I right?
Bodash, yeah, the old Latonia.
Yeah, what do you remember about that day?
A cold December day. I think it was a beast. I'm not for sure. It may have been January. It was cold. Oh, Latonia was cold. I remember that. Yeah, just a gelding that I bred, raised, and owned.
Yeah, that Latonia, of course, the former now Turfway Park. It was formerly Latonia. And so Bodash gets you started, kicks things off. I can imagine that had to be a great day for you. How'd you celebrate?
I think just went home and probably so exhausted. I don't remember. It's been so long ago, I can't really. I don't think there's probably much celebration because we knew we had to get back up early in the morning again to get back to work. So.
Well, that's a recurring theme with trainers on this show. You very rarely, when I ask that question, have trainers go, oh, we went out partying until 4 in the morning. I was so excited to have my first winner, because the beat goes on. The next day, this job is 365 days a year. You have to be at the barn.
That's right. And you're only as good as your last win. And you just have to get back, because horses have to be taken care of, have to be trained, and you've got to keep striving. And that's what does eliminate some people that get into the training end of this business, and they find out it's not for them.
Yeah, and you mentioned it's a little bit different now for a new person getting started than it was when you were getting started back in 1980. What advice, Phil, would you give to a young trainer that might be listening and thinking about getting into this game?
I would give them advice just to listen, find some mentors that you really believe in, listen to them, and don't be afraid to ask for advice or for help on both the horse end and the business end of it also.
So you never actually had a mentor, so to speak, because you just kind of went out on your own at the age of 18 and started doing this and learning trial by error. Is that right?
But pretty much. There's a gentleman when I first started, named Bill Davis. He had a horse named Dutail George. It was a pretty nice stake horse at the time. He won the Salvatore Handicap at the Meadowlands, and had another night, real nice filly named Shams Girl that won some stakes. And he was nice enough to he just trained a few horses of his own. He was nice enough to kind of help me out a little bit, and he gave me a colt named Brother George, who was a brother to Dutail George. And he was my first stake winner. It was old Keystone Racetrack up in Philadelphia, which
wow.
is of course now Parks.
Sure.
So and he had trained mainly just his own horses, but I could call Bill, or Bill would come around a couple times a week too, and just ask Bill, what do you think? What are you doing? And that helped me so much.
Yeah. What
his advice?
What are some of the what's the best advice you received when you were getting started?
King Dangerfield. He gave me real good advice when I got my trainer's license that day. He says, don't train horses too cheap, because you can't take care of them if you're doing it too. He said, you've got to charge enough to where you can take care of the horse in the right manner and also make a living. He said, you're not going to get rich, but you can make enough where you make a living also and take good care of your horses.
Wow. And that's served you well.
Uh-huh. Yeah. As they say, the horses come first, and they do.
Well, you've had a lot of really nice horses come through your care. Once you got started, got things rolling, business started to pick up, but you had to wait quite a long time before you picked up that first graded stakes winner, and that came in 2009 with Hot Cha-Cha and the Grade 3 Bourbonette Oaks, ironically enough, at Turfway Park. Tell me about Hot Cha-Cha, and tell me about that moment. It had to be very special.
Yeah, she was just such a kind filly. She was by Cactus Ridge. Alva Broad brush mare, and she was just, they say, just classy. She's kind of small filly, not very big. And she loved the poly track, but she was just a better turf horse, and what she eventually ended up being. That was such a great time when she won the Bourbonette Stakes, and I told Mr. McMacken, who bred and raised a filly, And the owner, I says, we got to try the Bourbonette. She's just doing so good right now. And I said, he said, you sure? I said, yeah, let's go for it. I said, I just excited about her. And she won that race, I think, by 6 or 7 lengths, just drew away from him. And she was just a real nice, exciting filly.
When you say she was a better turf filly, she proved that later on in the year when she took the Grade 1 QE2 Challenge Cup at Keeneland. And I can't even imagine, as somebody who's never saddled a horse, when you finally, after all those years of sacrifice and dedication and work, and it finally comes together and you get to the pinnacle of the sport with a Grade 1 winner, especially at Keeneland, where you grew up just a little over an hour from the track, how emotional was that for you?
Oh, that was it was, of course, a very happy moment for my owners, myself, and my two sons as well, just because they worked hard at the farm and it was just nice to realize that you could really do it. And we don't have expensive horses in the barn. We do have a few horses that maybe that we call have a lot of nice pedigrees, but most of the horses we have are just utility bred horses. And Hot Cha-Cha was one of those. She was a Cactus Ridge filly, which was an inexpensive stallion. And it's nice to get those and just kind of slay the giants per se with her, because she was just, we already felt she was a little underrated. She had won the Pucker Up Stakes before that, but we're just so happy for the filly as well at that moment.
You mentioned Cactus Ridge, the sire, owned by country music superstar Toby Keith. Did you ever get a chance to talk with Toby or meet Toby?
No, I haven't, and I would like to. I was going to try to at Oaklawn Park, but he was there one day at the races, but I missed him. But he owned race Cactus Ridge as well, and he's had some fine horses by that stallion.
Yeah, you won a Grade 1 for his stallion. I think he should write a song about you.
That would be a good idea.
Talking with trainer Phil Sims on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Phil, you mentioned your sons, and Matt still working with you. Both your boys work very hard. What's that like to have your sons involved with your operation?
Well, it's really good. Matt, he grew up, of course, going to the races with me, going to the barn on weekends, and then even before school and high school, working on the farm, just doing whatever needed to be done. And one of my brothers asked, so what does he do? I said, the things I don't really want to do that I've already done. But
well, what are kids for?
That's right. So it's really good. He kind of took my path in a way. He was going to go. We got out of high school. He was going to go to college. And we said and talked about it. I said, hey, I didn't want to encourage him to train horses, but I didn't want to discourage him either. And so I said, if that's what you want to do, just come on, let's go ahead and get started now. You can go ahead and learn the business and learn the in and outs of it, and also help me. And it's really good to have him as an assistant, because he has skin in the game as well. He owns a couple of horses of his own, and I just can really count on him, rely on him for everything I need him for.
Is it flattering when your son makes the decision that he wants to follow in his dad's footsteps?
It sure is, but then in the back of your mind also, it's like, I wish you would do something else that's a little more, say, stable. This business is so volatile that around the next 1 year is a great year, and next year may not be so good, and you have to put in so many hours. But if that's what you love to do, it's makes it much easier.
Well, and you know that better than anybody, considering what you went through, leaving college, going to training horses at the age of 18. You said he kind of followed the same path as you, and it sounds like he's on the right track.
He is. I'm very proud of him.
What advice do you give to him on a daily basis?
Just take your time. Try to keep. Try not to get down too much, because this business, as you know, can get you down. And if the horse doesn't run well, you just get kind of like, oh gosh. So just sit down, think about what maybe we can do to improve, and keep working hard.
Now, how about your other son? Is he still actively involved?
He's still in high school. He's a junior in high school, so he loves the races. He's a great handicapper, actually.
Really?
Yeah, he's very, very good. And He likes more the executive side of racing and management end. So I think that's the way he's going to go.
He might be running Keeneland someday.
That would be his dream.
So do both? I know Matt goes to the races with you, obviously, because he's your assistant. But your other son, is he there at the races with you quite often?
When he's not school, he can go. He loves to go to the races now. When I was growing up in high school, which was in the late 70s, my principal had told my parents that anytime that I needed to go to the breed, take a horse to the breeding shed or go to the races, I had a complete excused absence and no problems. So I probably, my senior year, I probably went to school half the time, which they can't do that now.
Now, you said he's a pretty good handicapper. Is he ever saying, hey, Dad, are we live today? Can I bet?
No, he doesn't ask me. I used to ask him.
What do you think of us today? What do you think of our chances?
Yeah, he's great about that though. He's a good handicapper. He's really good. So I ask him a lot of times, "Who do you like in a race?"
Wow. Now people listening to this interview are going to know right away that Phil Simms is very passionate about the sport of thoroughbred racing. And you have a quote on your website that says, "I have never lost enthusiasm for the pursuit of success, whether introducing new owners to the sport or selecting yearlings at auction. I thrive on the potential that each of them bring." And that really does sum up the Phil Simms philosophy, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, pretty much. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that still drives you, doesn't it?
It does. I love to have new people that haven't been in the horse business before get involved. And a lot of times I'll bring them in as partners on a horse with me, get their feet wet, and make sure that they really like it, if it's what they really want to do. And I find that much better way, as opposed to somebody jumping in and spending just tons of money. And so this isn't really for me. So it seems like once they get in as partners on a couple of horses and they have some fun and learn what the business is about, they do stay in much longer than if they just jumped in all at once.
That's undoubtedly one of your true strengths, Phil, is developing those relationships. What's the key to developing a strong relationship with your clients?
Just tell them what we have going on all the time, keep them informed. And I've had some clients I've had since I first started training. Mr. McMacken from here in Lexington's one. That's mainly just the key, is just to keep them informed, kind of know what we have going on, how the horses are doing, and what we think that we are with them. And it takes a lot of patience with these horses, of course, getting them to the races, and just keeping everybody kind of grounded, per se.
Yeah, and you mentioned keeping owners informed. There's two sides to that. Of course, the good news is always easy to deliver, but there are times when trainers have to make the phone call that they don't want to make, and for whatever reason, maybe a horse has to be laid up for a little bit or whatever it might be. How challenging is it for you to have to make those phone calls, Phil?
That's a hard, very hard part of this business, and making those calls. But most owners learn to accept that they realize things can go wrong. There's some setbacks and bumps in the roads with these horses. So and they know that I'm looking out for the best interest of their horse, and we're doing the right thing with them.
What have you enjoyed most about training horses over the past 30 plus years?
Oh, probably just young horses, picking out young horses to sales or breeding young horses and bring them along as 2-year-olds and having them develop into really good 3-year-olds.
Do you prefer buying yearlings over 2-year-olds in training?
Much more, yes. I prefer buying the yearlings much more over buying them as 2-year-olds in training.
How come?
Because I'm not in a big hurry with them, number one. I don't want to start a 2-year-old over 2 or 3 times generally as a 2-year-old. And then we can bring them along as we'd like for them to. Just like a lot of times we'll buy yearlings out of sale. I'll break them, maybe give them 60 days of riding on the farm, and then we'll stop on them for a few months and kind of start staggering them in. And even this time of year, I still have a few more 2-year-olds still to come to track. They're still on farms. They've been ridden, but they haven't been in training really. So we stagger. I like to stagger them. because if I buy them 3-year-olds in training in March or April, they've already been breezing and things like that, and we're not really that kind of that much of a hurry with our young horses.
What's the key to picking out the right horse when you go to the sale?
Just a lot of luck.
how do you know that the horse is the horse you're looking for?
You get that gut. You can tell pretty quick. It shouldn't take long to judge a horse if that's what you're looking for. You're looking for balance is one thing, and the horse's attitude is another. Also, is how they present themselves in the sales rings, but there's several things, but you'll know pretty quick if there's one you don't like either. If it's just not your type. Everybody has their own type of horse, I think, and I have mine that I like.
What's the ideal type of horse for Phil Sims?
Just a average size horse, balanced, and one is pretty good, pretty mentally in tune with its surroundings, and carries a lot of confidence in itself.
I can imagine that growing up around Lexington, you had the pleasure of watching so many of the greatest trainers the sport has ever seen, and I'm sure so many of them had an influence on your decision to become a trainer, Phil. Who was the greatest trainer, or maybe the trainer that you looked up to the most as you were a kid?
Of course, Dale Carroll was one, and Joe Bolero was another.
What was it about them?
Just their patience and the horsemanship they had. And the horses always looked so good. But I remember Mr. Bolero, he had so much patience with the horses. And he was of course a very good jockey also, which is unusual. A lot of riders don't make good trainers, but he did great at both.
Phil Sims on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Phil, with all the winners you trained, all the countless hours you put into the sport, what still motivates you?
Oh, just probably trying to bring along a young horse and hopefully that you can develop them and they turn out to be a pretty nice stake horse or something. That's what keeps you going. Because a lot of the horses I have, I own myself. I own a partnership, and we work hard on all of them and trying to get them developed and hope we get lucky with some of them.
Well, yeah, you've been to the top of the mountain, as we talked about earlier, winning a Grade 1 with Hot Cha-Cha and the QE2 Challenge Cup at Keeneland. Last year, you took the Grade 2 Chalukyi with Don't Tell Sophia. That was a big moment as well. What are some of the things that you're still looking to accomplish in the coming years?
Oh, just try to keep a strong stable. And with my son, he keeps a division, one of the divisions also. I keep a division at Church at Keeneland year-round. And he keeps right now he's at Churchill with that division, but just trying to develop and keep things going, the stable, and keep trying to develop new clients and new partners.
When Phil Sims gets a moment or two away from the racetrack, what are some of the things that you enjoy doing outside of racing, Phil?
There's not a whole lot of time for much of anything else, truthfully.
Why does every trainer say that?
I wish there was. I have some golf clubs. They're full of spider webs. I might play once a year in the farm manager's scramble, but not much else really. It's just about all I do. You try to read a book, but it takes you 3 years to get through a book because you fall asleep. Because as soon as you get home, you're so exhausted, you just go right to sleep and you're back up at 4:30 automatically. No alarm clock. 4:30, you're awake. So there's not much time for anything else. I do like to go to the mountains once in a while with some friends. They're in the horse business as well. We take a lead pony and go to the mountains for a couple of days and spend some time and just ride horses. But that's about it, really.
Well, Phil, you've been doing it the right way for a long time. You're a class act and a great ambassador for the sport of racing, and can't thank you enough for being with me here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton tonight. All the best moving forward, and all of our guests who appear on the program receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. I'll send those out to you, and again, thanks so much and good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, class act, Phil Sims here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Want to thank Marcus Vitale for being with me in the first half of the program as well. A couple of great interviews and great people that really have unbelievable stories and make this sport a success. Don't forget, you can catch us every single Wednesday night here on Sirius 220, XM 206, and streaming on our website, horseracingradio.net. Also, a podcast of the show available on our website as well. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.